You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 59, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format where you can learn about what physicians face through expert analysis. And today's expert is Dr. Nikhila Schroeder. Dr. Schroeder was born and raised in Wisconsin, attended college at MIT, where she earned her bachelor's and master's in engineering in both electrical and computer science engineering, concentrating in biomedical engineering and music. She then went to medical school at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, got married, moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, completed a pediatric residency and fellowship program in allergy immunology at the University of Virginia. As we'll discuss in the show, she then chose a private practice to work at for a number of years until she decided to strike it out on her own to practice her unique form of allergy immunology. She created a direct care clinic called Allergenuity, which is based in Charlotte, North Carolina. There she has a direct care clinic, which focuses on transparent pricing, meaning no third-party payers, and a deep connection with her patients, where she'll spend sometimes up to 2 hours getting to know her patients and their allergy concerns. Because of the uniqueness of the type of therapy that she provides, she has patients who come from all over, spanning 20 states and 3 countries. Links to her clinic, her social media presence, and other episodes that are related to this episode can all be found at theparadox.com/059. Of course, you can go to theparadox.com and sign up for email alerts so you know when new episodes come out and any interesting news about the show or things that I think will be relevant to your life. If you're not yet a subscriber to the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Thank you for sharing the show. It continues to grow, and I appreciate all the sharing and recommendations you make to colleagues and friends. And I will continue to strive to bring interesting topics, interesting people, interesting discussions to your podcast player on a weekly basis. I do apologize that I've been a little off my weekly show frequency, mainly because I'm still trying to help my wife launch her own podcast, which will deal with an entirely different subject than what I discuss here. But I think it's perhaps even more important than what I'm dealing with at this point. And when it comes to launch date, I'll make sure that I let everyone know. But without further ado, Dr. Nikhila Schroeder, story of her successful non-third-party payer allergy practice. Enjoy. Welcome. I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Nikhila Schroeder of Allergenuity Health in North Carolina. And we're going to talk today about her practice in North Carolina and what she's doing. So, Dr. Schroeder, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you give us a little backstory? I think what I often get questioned when I'm, you know, in the OR, people are like, "How do you come up with guests? How do you find people?" And I always tell them it's sort of like one of those things where you're not always necessarily looking for someone. But serendipity, you know, you come across, if you go to the right places, you might find people or interesting stories. And yours is a situation where I have a partner who just joined my group. His wife's an allergist, you're an allergist, and she's looking for a job. And so I kind of went to my strange places Facebook and other places, like, "Hey, do you know any ways of starting your own practice if you had to? Is anyone out there really doing this sort of thing?" And that's sort of how we stumbled into each other. So you are in practice by yourself, and you're not part of an employed system. So I know you were initially. So why don't you tell your story about how you started practice? Because I know you're a board certified pediatrician. Then you went to as an allergist, and then you went into sort of employment. So and then you left. So kind of go through that sort of initial move.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So I, yes, I did, just like, you know, all other physicians, sort of the traditional track, after college, went to med school and, then, tried to decide what I wanted to do, in terms of specialty afterwards. And initially I was actually planning to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. You might come across, some publications that I did out there in that, from a long time ago, because I was focused on that. All my mentors were in that. I had seen a heart transplant. I was fortunate enough to shadow a heart transplant when I was in high school. And oh, I just thought it was the coolest thing to be able to help someone like that. I already knew I wanted to be a doctor. But when I saw that, and I actually was holding someone's heart in my hand when I was, I think, 15, and looking down at a person who, you know, at that moment, did not have a heart in their body. And there was one in a box that we were about to put in, and there was one that had just been removed, and the person was alive. And I got to, you know, after it was all done, I got to speak with him, you know, the next week. And it just blew my mind. And I thought, hey, if I can do this with my life, you know, that would be just a really great thing to be able to do and to offer people. So that was kind of my mindset at first was, I'm a hands-on person. I like to use my hands. I turned out to be pretty good at procedures, and surgical things. So it was all kind of fitting together that I would go that route first. And, long story short, directed myself towards that direction. And then realized that other pieces of the puzzle to being a cardiothoracic surgeon maybe weren't the best fit for me in the long run. And the sort of family life I wanted, and being a woman physician. Unfortunately, there's different factors that we still wind up having to take into account with that. And it just turned out that probably in the long run, that wouldn't be a good fit for me, even though I think I would have been good at doing the surgery. And so then I started thinking, what were my other passions? What else had I liked in med school? And I'm a problem solver. I like critical thinking and I like figuring things out. And so the immune system had always eluded me because it's super complex. And I thought, you know, only crazy people go into anything with immunology. I was like, I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. So initially I was kind of trying to stay away from that. And I also loved children. Even though I was fascinated with immunology, but thought, you know, I should stay away from that, for my own sanity. I knew I didn't have to pick a specialty yet. I just had to pick my first course. Was it going to be adults? Was it going to be children? Was it going to be family practice sort of thing? And I decided that I wanted to help, take care of children. And so I went into pediatrics and, did my residency at UVA, in Charlottesville, Virginia, and, loved taking care of children. It's just has always been a passion of mine. Although I did miss taking care of adults, I had never not liked it. So I missed a little bit of that. And so when it came time to figure out what to do after that, I revisited things and found myself going down two routes. One was sort of back into cardiology. I thought maybe I'd do pediatric cardiology and then maybe subspecialize from there into procedural things again, and realized I was just essentially going back the same way that I had decided.
Right, it's not much different.
Yeah. No. And suddenly I have to remember why I chose to not do this before. And then went back to what else fascinates me and again came to the immune system. And this time, you know, I still thought, oh, that's crazy. I shouldn't do it. but I had sort of gravitated to allergy care, and solving those immune problems, or trying to, during my residency anyway. And, my colleagues started sending me their tough, allergy cases. And, I just sort of had a natural fit with that, or a natural passion, I guess, that came out. And So decided to bite the bullet and be one of those physicians that deals with the immune system every day. So went into fellowship, stayed at UVA. And after that, had the branch point that all of us have where, what do we do next?
Yeah.
So I, to be honest, had already seen some of the things I knew I would struggle with in the healthcare system, being employed in kind of the traditional system for a long time. So I already felt rushed with my patients, which I didn't like. That was not what I got into healthcare for. I wanted to get to know people in order to figure out how to help them. And I felt like a lot of times I wasn't given that the time that I wanted or the time that I felt I needed with a patient. I felt like sometimes the critical thinking aspect was stifled. When I could get to know a patient, I would try to understand their goals, their fears and concerns and anxieties, their lifestyle, and their, what's important to them. And of course their medical conditions, and trying to figure out how to help. And sometimes the way to help them was quite outside the box thinking. And oftentimes I found myself hitting a wall where, even though I had come up with a great plan that would have really helped the patient, either the insurance company wouldn't let me and wanted me to go through a bunch of other steps I knew wouldn't work first.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or, something within my clinic wouldn't let me, or didn't follow the practice parameters exactly. And people were worried about liability, and all these things. And it was really, it just broke my heart as a physician, because I felt like, well, what am I doing here? If I can't use my brain and my heart to help people, then, what am I doing? But, couldn't you just have a computer system? I used to be a computer programmer before I did engineering for undergrad and computer science.
Yeah.
So I was like, if all I'm supposed to do is regurgitate, why don't I just use my other hat and program something that just diagnoses people and spits out, the current practice parameters and hooks into someone's insurance formulary and uses whatever their first line is, regardless of, of what might actually be a good fit for that patient. Because if that's all I'm supposed to do, then why am I here? So it was really, I was already frustrated kind of as a young physician, decided to start my journey of doing something a little different, right out the gate there. So I, interviewed at hospitals and I interviewed at private practices. And, one thing that was different about what I wanted to pursue was I wanted to learn about a allergy procedure or treatment that was not part of our mainstream training in the U.S. So I'm sure you have heard of allergy shots. Everybody's heard of allergy shots.
Sure. So, my daughter and my wife got them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So pretty common treatment for allergies. If you either need more than medicine or avoiding, if you can't avoid your triggers, or you need more than medications, or you just are looking to try to actually change your underlying allergies to some things, then you, we usually recommend some form of immunotherapy. And allergy shots is the thing that every allergy clinic is set up for. And has been going on in the U.S. for decades and decades and decades. So I learned that in my training. And this could be a whole other podcast, but I wasn't completely thrilled with it. I thought it was very useful, but I thought, hey, we miss a lot of groups of people that could really use this type of help because of the risks of this procedure and because of the time constraints. So, for example, we can't use it for young children. Some people, it's just, coming in weekly, is too much, getting injections is painful. And on and on. And so, there are lots of, I was looking for a better way. I thought what if there's a better way that people know of already, or what if I could create a better way? Long story short, I learned about the different parts of the body and how the immune system works there. And I thought that the mouth seemed like a good route to pursue for building tolerance. And so it's sort of the gateway to our body, to the inside of our body, right? We
sure
breathe through our mouth. We eat things that we need for nourishment, and we drink water. And those immune cells are actually designed to try to promote tolerance. And so that brought me to sublingual immunotherapy, which maybe we'll talk about more. And that brought me to the next step in my career, because I wanted to find a place that did that. And there are not a lot of places in the U.S. that do that or do that well. And I found a place in Wisconsin that had been doing it for 50 years, 40 years at that point. And thankfully was able to get a position there and learned this treatment there and found it to be phenomenal. So
now this was right after, I'm sorry, oh, this is right after residency or were you in a
right after fellowship.
Traditional?
Yep. I went into,
right after, so you finished your fellowship. Yep. And then, okay. Yep. Gotcha.
Did residency, then did traditional fellowship for allergy and immunology. Mm-hmm. And then this was my first position afterwards. So I had a position at a children's hospital that all my mentors wanted, you know, they're like, that's
right. Right.
What are you doing? They're yep. like, go there, do that, you know? And had a private practice, kind of traditional private practice offer, and then had this offer at this very unique clinic, private practice clinic, that did this very different type of treatment. And all my mentors told me, you know, were highly advising me against it. I had, you know, literally zero academic support for that decision. They didn't think it was a good
idea. Why is that?
Yeah, they... So I asked that too. they didn't think it was, they basically thought that if I went that outside of the box at that time, they thought it would ruin the good academic reputation that I had built, that it might be tough if I went there and decided I didn't like the treatment or that it didn't help people the way I was hoping it would, and then tried to get back into the more classic allergy system, mm-hmm. that maybe I wouldn't be as well accepted. And so I think they were well-meaning in that they were doing their best to try to look out for me from their perspective of, hey, we think we've enjoyed working with you. We think you're a good allergist. Why rock the boat and go do something that might, make other people not see you that way because you've stepped out and done something that some other people might consider, you know, like witch doctory or something.
Quackery, you know? Right? I mean, they worry about quackery.
Yeah.
Actually, my last interview was with the physician who was integrative medicine, where you're sort of putting into practice things that are outside the traditional medicine. So I guess you would say, for those who are not familiar with immunotherapy, essentially what you're doing is you're desensitizing people to things, right? So you're giving someone, for allergy shots, you're giving a small sample of whatever it is that they might be allergic to, mm-hmm. and they're getting a shot, basically, of, you know, grass pollen, tree pollen, whatever.
Yep.
Not actually the full pollen, but anyway, it's a,
yeah.
And that it builds up, and it basically desensitizes you, so you have less of a reaction to it when you're experienced out in the environment. And what you were looking to do was sublingual,
mm-hmm.
which is under the tongue. So it's basically, you know, an oral therapy. And it's the same concept, except that I suppose the things that you more like to put in your mouth for like foods and things. But your immune system is everywhere within your body. It's not just in your skin. It's in your gut. And so anywhere that has, you know, immune responses, you can obviously get you can use this desensitization process. And the traditional part of medicine in the United States was just using allergy shots. Mm-hmm. And so anything outside that, these academics were essentially seeing as, well, it's not maybe proven as well. There's not as much academic literature in this. It's not established. It's not the usual route of curing allergies or treating them.
Right.
And so they do see it. They viewed it as quackery. And so that was kind of the hang up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that pretty
it was exactly
good summary.
It was not the usual thing. You know, it's not our practice parameters. And that always, I guess, has bothered me from the get-go, again, as a person who likes to think through problems. I appreciate practice parameters. I understand them. I understand why they're there. Of course, we all need to learn the building blocks and to be able to help patients as best as we can. But after that, once you've learned the building blocks, you know, I always thought that one of the beautiful parts of being a physician or scientist is that then you get to think through things and see if you can do things better. And or for a particular patient, if there's a way, you know, if you need to change something for one person versus what you do for, you know, the other 10 people, because that one person has a different situation, a different health issue, or a different concern, or a different degree of risk with something. And so what was tough for me is when everything outside the box, you know, is kind of blown off as has no potential, rather than looking at everything with an open mind first and saying, let's dig in and see if there's potential. Because obviously there's some stuff out there. There's a bunch of people out there doing a bunch of crazy things, unfortunately, sure, yeah. You know, and it's really tough. And I as a patient, it's hard, I think, to figure out what to pursue. You have a lot of people, some qualified, some not, telling you a bunch of things. It's hard to figure out who they are, what their background is, and what the validity of what they're telling you is. And so it gets really tricky. But I don't think that means that everything that's not the typical practice parameters or the typical, whatever is FDA approved, I don't think that those are the only good things. I think there are a lot of really good things that, you know, maybe aren't FDA approved for that purpose, but that's a whole other topic too. That's not what the FDA approval process is for. Right. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. And then there's, insurance companies will cover certain things and not other things. And they are, you know, for the most part, they don't want to cover things. And they try, you know, they cover some of the things that are FDA approved, or they source what they cover from that. And it's a lot easier to say, oh, that's not FDA approved, so we won't cover it. Which then can potentially, you know, put the mindset of, oh, and it's not a good thing because it's not covered. But that's not true either necessarily. I mean, a large percentage of stuff we do with children is technically not FDA approved for that thing because the study wasn't done in that age group.
Absolutely.
You know, and so there's a lot of off-label use of things all throughout medicine, some that for whatever reason is accepted or is just kind of glossed over that people just miss. I don't think a lot of people even realize it's off-label. But then other things that are off-label that suddenly people think, oh, you know, you're going to ruin your reputation if you do that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my story of, at least in the traditional part of how I got to where I was within the classic system. So I'm a person who overall is kind of risk averse, but when I'm doing something that I believe is right or will help someone, I somehow get some strength and courage that maybe I don't have at other times. And so I took the step out of the system or out of the classic allergy pathway and went to a clinic to learn sublingual immunotherapy. But that was still in a fairly traditional clinic other than doing this outside of the box treatment. It was still in the insurance managed system, still all the same pressures of, you know, see more patients, see them in a shorter period of time, trying to get things approved through insurance and doing whatever the insurance said we could do and not doing other things. And that was still really tough for me. And finally I had some other ideas of where I wanted to take sublingual immunotherapy. I thought there was a lot of potential there and I had a lot of creative ideas there as well. And at that clinic, you know, they they were already outside of the box with what they were doing. And I, you know, I don't know that they wanted to change that. They had been doing okay with what they were doing. And you know, so when I wanted to bring some new stuff to the table, you know, it maybe reached their limit of what they wanted to change at the time. And so, you know, my husband and I just really thought about things, and it was really tough, because we have two young children as well. We were paying off student loans, you know, so not sitting on a nest egg of any kind. And, but I was kind of miserable and I didn't know what to do. I just thought, I can't do this for my entire career. This is not what I thought being a doctor would be. And so we talked a lot and we tried to figure out the tough decisions. And in the end, we had always joked that, you know, maybe when we're like 60, you know, we would open our own clinic and get that set up and then try to retire, you know, and just help manage the clinic or something. But here I found myself in my 30s thinking, wow, I've been in the healthcare field for about 15 years. And although fairly, you know, still fairly young in my long-term career, I had been in it well long enough to realize that I was burnt out. I didn't like it. I wasn't going to sustain myself that way. And I didn't feel good about, you know, my interactions because I felt like there was always pressure to do something that I didn't want to do. So the only way to try to break out of that was to try to start our own thing. So we decided that that would be the next step, as scary as that has been. And that's how we came to opening our own clinic in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And I, you know, this, it's fascinating, these decisions, because as someone, I think I'm as risk averse as you, if not more so. I'm not creative enough to see outside the box to find entrepreneurial ways of conducting my own business. And I don't, I mean, there are anesthesiologists who've done things. So I have no excuse except that just my lack of creativity. And I think that one thing that people discount or don't recognize is there is a lot of room for innovation within the healthcare system. Within the confines of how it's structured, there's not as much room for innovation and disruption. But if you were to unlock all these physicians to do things, many of them would do things that don't work and fail. But there's plenty of room for people to do things like you're doing with this, you know, this certain therapy and a different way of delivering it to patients and have a different model for delivering the care. And, you know, maybe the hybrid model, which is, I don't know, that's probably a poor way of putting it, but the model that, where you train, where they accept traditional insurance, and then people, I imagine, paid out of pocket for the sublingual therapy. Which is actually a practice here in Grand Rapids, which is exactly the same. They have their sort of your traditional allergy clinic, but they also do offer the sublingual. My wife's a pediatrician and says actually the sublingual is fantastic. She thinks it's great for lots of her patients that she's had gotten. It's worked really well for food allergies and things. And so there's definitely a lot of fear. And I mean, was the main fear for you, was it how you're going to support your family? Because that seems to be a lot of the fear of a lot of people coming out of fellowship at residency. Most people, I've mentioned this a number of times in the show, you're coming out with $200,000 to $250,000 of debt, most people on average. And that's not nothing.
No.
You've got to pay that back.
That's a lot.
And if you suddenly go into a place where you've got to lay down some capital to open your clinic and have, it's a lot more comfortable to go into a practice where they're going to either pay your loan back or guaranteed salaries. And yeah, it may not be exactly the way you want to practice, but you're like, well, that's sort of the trade-off I've got to make, because I've got to make sure, you know, my family eats and that they've, you know, have clothes and those sorts of things, which I know people don't think that happens with physicians, but you absolutely make those decisions.
Oh yeah.
Because, you know, having zero income is really tough when you expect to pay back, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 a month in student loan.
Absolutely.
Payments.
Yes. That was probably one of our two big fears. And you know, the biggest one was the financial aspect. So, you know, I was only 3-4 years out of my training. So I, you know, I hadn't had a long time to pay, you know, have a typical physician salary. You know,
I
just started. And when we had our children, we had decided we wanted one of us to be staying home with our children. And mm-hmm. so my husband was a stay-at-home dad. We had two children after my allergy fellowship while I was working at the other private practice. So, you know, we had one income. We just had my income. And tons of student loans for myself from undergrad, for my husband from his undergrad, from my medical school. And of course, all the interest that had racked up while during residency and fellowship, where you don't get paid enough to pay your student loans, pay back on your student loans. And so you just have, they let you kind of defer those payments, but you still rack up interest. So you actually, your loans grow during that time. And so, yeah, we had a lot of loans. We still do. Before we had decided to open our own clinic, you know, before that was when I was kind of fresh out starting my new job, you know, one of our goals, we were like, we're not going to change our lifestyle at all. We're going to live very kind of meagerly and just like we were before. And we're going to save and try to pay down things. And so that's what we were doing. Then, of course, we had children and they were expensive at the hospital. And they were expensive outside of the hospital. Our first house was a little rental house that was overrun by mice. And that was fine for my husband and I to save money. And but then when we had children, we, you know, we needed a place that was safer for them. And that brought a little bit of extra expense. So we, you know, there's a lot of expenses for a young doctor just starting out to cover, and then someone who starts their family. And certainly was not the time that we had ever envisioned opening our own clinic because of the risk that comes with that, and certainly the financial risk that comes with that. You know, we didn't have a huge nest egg of money that we could invest into a clinic. We didn't. We also didn't have the ability to, you know, take on a huge financial risk, although I guess we sort of did. You know, it was not necessarily the most comforting thought to say, hey, let's do something that will not give us stable income and or will not give us any income for quite a while. And it's a big unknown. So I suppose that's somewhat of a testament of how miserable I was and how miserable I think a lot of physicians are in the classic system, that we somehow, you know, even logically weighing out all of these pros and cons and not being big risk takers ourselves in general, somehow still came to the conclusion that that this was a good idea or it was, you know, worth trying. Because when you really look at it, and we actually just thought this through again a couple weeks ago. We hit our 1 year anniversary for our clinic, and we were, you know, excited about that, and we were reminiscing a little bit about the past year and thinking through how we started everything, and this topic came up. We were talking about it, and we went through our thought process before and how everything started, and we were like, we must have been in a different frame of mind then and had some sort of like adrenaline or extra bravery or courage, like soup or something that we had eaten, because this seems like this was like, you know, maybe not the smartest idea when we have two young children and no money to venture into moving across the country and opening our own clinic that does something very different that we had to then explain to everybody. And, and one piece of advice I would give anybody who is thinking about this that we didn't know that I wish I had known was so I had just had my second child, went back from maternity leave and was finishing out my last 4 or 5 months at the clinic after I'd given my notice. And it was busy. You know, I had two young children. I was trying to fit in a bunch of patients. They wanted to see me before I left. And so I was trying to do a lot of things and get everything teed up for them so that transition of care would be good. And so I was working really hard. And I knew that I would need my medical license in the new state And it takes a while. So I applied for that ahead of time. But I was kind of like, everything else we'll do after we move, because I wanted to get to know some of the banks in the area, to look into loans, and I didn't know the paperwork I'd need for, the state paperwork I'd need to set up a business. And so there's a lot more I had to learn. And all of it seemed like stuff that was okay to push off until we were done, except for my medical license. So I was working really hard and doing all this stuff. And I did not at all realize that it would be almost impossible, if not impossible, to get a loan, like a startup business loan, after my employment is complete, like after I have left. And so, because one of the things they wanted was, hey, what's your current salary?
Right. Zero.
They don't like the Give answer zero. Yeah. So, that was eye-opening, because we didn't have a loan in place before I left. We just hadn't thought to do that. And since my husband and I were doing this together, so one of the other things was, we wanted, when we thought about our life, we realized how much we missed, seeing each other. We were apart our whole day. And then we have children and, so it was just busy. And so we decided to open this clinic together and work together. And so there was going to be, no outside income. A lot of people, I think, who open their own clinic, they have a spouse that has an income source and or they're moonlighting. But we had so much to do that I couldn't really have a moonlighting position, or I tried to ask for part-time allergy positions when we moved, and nobody was really interested in hiring for that. And then because I wanted to be direct care and be out of the system, I had to opt out of Medicare and things like that. And once you do that, it's really hard to get hired anywhere because they want you to be in the insurance system. Choosing not to be, then it's hard for them to hire you. So I couldn't really get a moonlighting position. And then my husband was going to be working with me in the clinic, and we had not applied for a loan while I had employment. So that was a huge thing. So if anybody's listening to this and is thinking about doing it, that's one thing I would definitely say, to apply for your business loan while you're still employed. It'll be a lot easier. You'll be able to get probably whatever you need. And you won't have to do what we did, which was then self-fund our clinic startup expenses from our own pocket, which we had just tried to save up to live off of.
Right, right.
So,
this brings us to, I guess, some of the present. You have a clinic now that is, you described sort of why you left the system. You left the system, you didn't like the third-party system. It's sort of algorithmic. What you do, your treatment regimen is dictated by outside sources. Mm-hmm. And so you wanted to just break free of that, and you open your own clinic where you are direct pay. And so I talk a number of people about direct primary care, which is where you have a monthly fee. There's no third party administrator in between. There's no middlemen, really. It's just the financial relationships between the patient and the physician.
Yep.
And I hate saying it's an honest transaction, but it feels more honest in that everyone sort of has upfront about the costs and sort of what the treatment is. And so you have more understanding of what's going on, I think, and you have a vested interest in knowing why you're doing certain things, because you're paying out of your pocket. No one goes into a restaurant and just orders, I'll have some food. I mean, they're always, they're making it some sort of educated decision about what they're going to eat.
Correct, right.
And so that process has to happen, with the physician in your practice.
Yep.
Why don't you describe, you're now a year in, so clearly you're not destitute.
Thankfully.
Are you doing as well as you were when you were employed financially?
Right now, no. Okay. We're a year in, and we are When we invested our own money into our startup expenses, since we couldn't get a loan.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that was somewhere around $30,000 to $40,000. We wound up having to put in. A lot of that, that can vary so much for different clinics. I've definitely heard of direct primary care clinics being able to start up less than that. And then some other clinics, they do a full build out for their place and it costs a lot more. With allergy, if there's a direct care or if there's an allergist who's thinking about this, one of the biggest costs, expenses is the allergy serum. It's the antigen.
Of course, yeah.
Which is a lot more expensive than I ever knew. You know, when you're employed, nobody, you don't get to see that side of the, you know, right, you're not part right. of the purchasing of things. So when you're prescribing the allergy shots, but you don't know actually how much that serum costs. And it's expensive. So that was eye-opening because we went into things thinking, okay, well, we kind of made some guesses at what prices we wanted to charge, and we wanted to make this super affordable for everybody, you know. And then when they don't make it easy to find the prices. That's another thing I learned as a physician. Some of the medical supply places and pharmaceutical mm-hmm. companies, it's not like they just lay their prices out there. It's the same problem, you know, that patients face in the system is you don't know what you have to like go through all these hoops and sometimes spend a lot of time and invest a lot of time to later find out a price and then not be happy about it. We just found out that was quite expensive. And so that was a large part of our initial expense. We chose to, you know, of course, everybody wants the big flashy clinic up front. And sometimes that lends a bit of credibility, I think, to a clinic, or at least in mm-hmm. some patients' eyes. You know, you see the big space with a bunch of staff and you feel like it's got to be a good place and they know what they're doing. That's really hard, I think, to achieve when you're right away. And unless you have a lot of funding. And sometimes if you start out the gate with a big staff, everybody's brand new and the whole thing's brand new to everybody, it can get really, from what I've heard from other folks who have started this way, and from patients that have gone to clinics like that, it can get very disorganized because everybody's learning at the same time and nobody knows what they're doing. Yeah. And so, so we chose to start small. We said, you know what, we're going to build this brick by brick, very organically. We did not know how that was going to go. We just said, you know, a large part of what we think is missing is the relationships between patients and physicians and staff. And when that relationship door is kind of opened and you get to know one another, I don't think people care about the big flashy clinic. They care about you and the care you're providing and if they trust you and those sorts of things. And
sure.
And it's hard yeah. to, you know, before anybody knows you, it's hard to get people to necessarily know that they can trust you. But we hoped that somehow we could just start getting to know people and then, you know, bit by bit, that door would open. And so we started by subleasing from somebody else. So we just had a room mm-hmm. in a clinic from another new doctor who had a, you know, bigger space but wasn't going to use all of it. And we did that for about 5-6 months. And they were growing and we were growing, which was super cool. We were growing by word of mouth. So we haven't really advertised at all. It's been all word of mouth, which I think is great and means a lot.
Absolutely.
And then, so then we looked for our own place, and now we have kind of a 800 square foot small clinic space. It's big enough for what we need now, but as we're growing, I think we'll need to expand a little bit. But we'll have this space for at least 2 years, and it's all ours, which is cool, and has 3 rooms and a bathroom and a little extra workroom, kitchenette sort of place. So that has been nice. Financially, I think we broke even at about 6 months.
That's great.
So we lived off of our own savings exclusively, for mm-hmm. a little over a year. And then we had also invested some of that into the clinic. And yeah, at right. 6 months we had made enough to cover the work expenses we had for those 6 months. And then after a few months, we were able to start paying back our initial investment in ourselves. still no
we
income,
build the savings.
But we were getting at least that chunk of money that we had invested back. So we were able to start living off of that because our savings had been rapidly depleted. And then the last kind of 4 or 5 months, we've been able to start taking, an income, a salary from our earnings. And it's just kind of growing little by little, it's growing. And so our hope is that next year, it's our hope and it's our necessity, because if this doesn't happen, we don't have any more money. Our hope and necessity for next year is that we're fully living off of the revenue that we generate through our clinic. So we're covering our business expenses and our personal expenses for year two, I hope. And then year three is when I hope we then, hopefully can branch more into maybe living a little more comfortably, having more money to kind of start putting back into investing for retirement and all of those other things that are smart to do and that you need to do, but that you cut out when you, are just trying to get money to feed your children. So
sure. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
So yeah, so we're nowhere near, making what an allergist would make in the traditional system after just a year in, but we didn't expect to be. I think it would have been naive to expect to be, so we knew we had to prepare for that. But we've been steadily growing and we're sort of on track with what our projections were. And if we keep going this way, we had to take a 2-3 year sacrifice, pretty big financial sacrifice for it, but we should be able to get to the point where we're back at a hopefully a comfortable place, but now doing work in a way that we love instead of doing work in a way that we, were miserable at before.
Right.
So,
well, because now you're eating, you've got clothes on your back, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a roof over your head.
Yeah.
You've got obviously like a cell phone, so you're not destitute.
Yeah. Although we did let our iPhone go. We couldn't do it. It was, we were like $1,000 per phone. We're like, nope.
Yeah. Right.
Can't do that. But yes, we're very blessed. I mean, it's hard. It's certainly hard to do. I don't want anybody to, who's thinking about it to have any misconceptions about that. You have to be prepared to make some tough choices. I broke down kind of in tears a little bit one day. I remember at the store when I was making choices for food for our kids. And I found myself making choices that I didn't want to be, that I was like, I shouldn't be making this choice at this point. Like, I'm a physician. Yeah. I have worked so hard to have a career path that, that hopefully, contributes to society, and also that, all the hard work I put in should give me a stable income to take care of my family. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why do I find myself here making some really tough choices between like quality of food, where I want to be getting a certain quality of food for my family, and here I've done all this hard work to hopefully be able to do that, and yet I'm not feeling comfortable just being able to do that. Thinking, oh my gosh, I don't think I have the funds to do this. How can I stretch this out, or what can I, and making those choices that I did before for myself, when I had no money. But it's totally different than thinking of your children. And it of course, makes you think of all the people who are struggling with that every day. It hurt my heart a bit. It made me question, should we have done this right now? But we're trying to build our whole life towards a better quality of life for our family. We didn't want to be at the office all the time and be coming home miserable. That takes a toll if you're coming home stressed every day. And I was charting all evening and I was, so I don't want.
There's value in that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is tough and people need to know that, but, we're blessed. And I think a lot of physicians are, have worked hard, and that has helped put them in a blessed position as well. They've done the steps to get themselves in a spot where it's tough. You have all these loans, you have all these other requirements, but if you really want it and you want to try to break out of the system that's making you miserable, you do have to make some more tough choices, and you have to save up some stuff and back off on some, conveniences and niceties that maybe you were finally building towards, that you felt like you finally deserved after all of this, mm-hmm. And you might have to take a step back. But you're thankfully in a position probably that you can try to do so. Like we were, to save up, a bunch of funds to be able to say, hey, we can live off of this for a year. We can't live, you know, the high life for a year, but we can survive off of this for a year and try to start this new clinic to do things better.
Well, and you've created something too, which is special. You know, yeah. That not many people get to say they're able to do that, and to set a situation for your work where you're working the way you want to and with who you want to.
Right.
You
yeah.
know, not many people can say that and can pull it off. So it's pretty cool. I mean, I know it's for me, it's easy to sitting where I am and just saying, oh yeah, you're doing great. You know, you're like, well, I'm, you know, just getting by. But what you're doing is pretty remarkable. And I, you know, I'm sure you feel that way now looking at it a lot more than you did probably 6 months ago when you guys were just breaking even, wondering if this thing's going to actually ever work.
Yes.
And so
we pretty much, it was every day was a swing of emotions. It was, you know, we'd see a patient, and it would go really well. They'd be so grateful. And, we'd have figured out some stuff that for them that we couldn't have done or couldn't have set up for them before. And we'd be on this high of like, wow, we're doing the right stuff. This is great. We're finally doing it the right way. And then, you know, we'd get a bill that evening or something.
Right.
And
yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
We'd look at our bank account and then we'd like freak out because we were like, oh no, like what are we doing? Like we can't do this. And so it was highs and lows and there were lots of tears and lots of leaning on each other. You know, one of us would break down and the other person would be strong. But you know, those start evening out over time to more of a, the lows aren't as bad. And the highs, you know, really give you wind beneath your wings to like know that you're on the right path and to keep going. And so, you know, yeah, we're a year in now and it's a totally different place than a year ago. And I, you know, I hope, and I've heard from other people that have done similar types of journeys, you know, a year from now will feel totally different than right now. And
yeah, sure.
So, but right now we get to, you know, I spend 2 to 3 hours with a new patient. And now I can't even remember, like, I can't even fathom how I didn't before.
Oh, I bet.
You know, I'm like, how did I do this in when I was double, triple booked? And I, you know, because my employer would be like, well, if somebody doesn't show, we need the spot filled.
Right.
You know, and I get it from their perspective too, because they're like, if we don't have the spots filled and then we're fighting with insurance companies for reimbursements because they don't want to give the reimbursements, you know, and we have all these open spots because somebody didn't show, like then we, like, you know, then they're losing revenue that they need to run the clinic. And so, I mean, I understood, but it just didn't work for me because I was like, well, you know, you already gave me too short of a time. And now I have two or three people that I'm supposed to squeeze in because everybody showed. So what am I
supposed right,
to
exactly.
And now, you know, I spend 2 hours with somebody easily, but I get to know them. They get to know me. They have questions. I get to give them answers. We get to just really get to know each other. If they have I see a lot of children. I see both kids and adults, but certainly a lot of children right now. And, you know, I spend half of the visit sitting on the ground playing with them while I'm talking to the parents, you know, but the kids then get to know me too in a more personal way. And then when they come back for their second visit, or if I have to do skin testing on them or something like that, because I, right now it's just me. So I do all of it. So I don't have
right,
staff
yeah,
doing
yeah.
skin testing. You know, the kids, they run in and give me a hug. You know, they're not scared of me. I'm not the scary doctor that might, and even though I do sometimes have to poke and prod at them to get information, you know, they know me and they trust me. And I spend time with them. And I think that's so huge and so underappreciated by the employment kind of system and what has become of healthcare is that, you know, people's health is it's a big deal to all of our health is, you know, our health is our life. And, mm-hmm. and if we're going to trust somebody to give us advice on it or to try to help us through it, like we do when we're a patient, and we're seeking care from a doctor, you know, we, all of us, I think want to feel like we know that person too. And we understand them as a person and that we feel like we can trust where they're coming from with their advice. And so that's one of the great things that I get to do now is I feel like I do that. I know all my patients' names. I know all their parents' names or vice versa. I know the kids' names of the parent if I'm seeing them. I usually know their pets' names, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just it's so much different and so much better.
And so I think, you know, your clinic, you have everything transparently priced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I started this talking to people who are direct primary care, I would tell people about direct primary care and how they're, you know, people they're working with outside the third party payer system. And then I always inevitably get the next question I get from, you know, I'm talking to people in the OR or just friends or whatever. They're like, well, is that something that can translate to people who are outside of primary care? Because episodic care, or, you know, if you're someone who has a heart attack, you're obviously not going to have a longstanding right. relationship with a cardiologist, maybe afterwards, but certainly not before.
Right.
And so I always get the question, is this a model that would work? Meaning basically, do you have to have a healthcare system that is where the primary source of care is through a third party payer? Do we have to have insurance-based system for the majority of care? And then even if you say, well, primary care, you don't, they'll say, well, that's fine. But, you know, there's all kinds of other stuff people see people for.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to have that? And now talking to you, I've talked to cardiologists, I've talked to a rheumatologist. I mean, I get the impression that probably this, because it's so expensive now with healthcare,
mm-hmm.
that this is becoming a more feasible and more one that patients are also willing to think outside the box as far as seeking care. Through, you know, non-traditional manner, I suppose. I mean, do you feel like we're kind of nearing a tipping point where people are going to start looking for this sort of thing and they're going to start providing that practice the opportunity?
I do. It's tough. I don't blame any physician. I think a lot of physicians want to do this, but I don't blame anybody for feeling like, oh, well, I can't. I don't know. I don't know if I want to take that on because
right.
it is tough. But I do. And it's tough, I think, for patients as well. You know, we all get into kind of certain habits and mindset, and society kind of pushes us all certain directions. And right now, it's even though insurance coverage has gotten just overall, you know, so terrible, we all are sort of programmed from the last several decades that we need insurance. Which, you
right.
know, in concept, in theory, insurance is a great thing. Of course, there's some big bad things that can happen and that none of us could afford to pay for if we didn't, you know, kind of pool resources collectively, which is theoretically what insurance mm-hmm. is supposed to be, to cover
yeah, right.
those big things. But that's sort of not what insurance has become. It's been more, you know, they take people's money and then don't give it all back into the pool. But we're all programmed to think, you know, gosh, we're paying so much for our insurance premiums and we're paying into that system so much that we have to try to use it, even though we're feeling like we don't actually get to use it a lot. So, you know, we have to see an in-network doctor and we have to, you know, follow the whatever rules the insurance company sets up for medications or only get whatever they'll cover. When in reality, we don't. Every person has the right to choose their physician, and health insurance should not be synonymous with health care. Although I feel like,
right.
it sort of has become that way. Even in my own mind, it's, you know, we have insurance and mm-hmm. first thought
yep.
is always, well, where, you know, who would we go to that this would cover because we're paying,
who's in network
paying yeah. so much money for this insurance. At the same time, our deductible is $13,500. So, for pretty much anything other than something catastrophic happening, you know, we're paying out of pocket for whatever appointment we have anyway for a long time. And so, for example, I had an appointment for 5 minutes. It was like a medication refill sort of appointment. I spent literally 5 minutes at most, that might be generous, with a physician who just needed to ask me a couple questions. I mean, it was a very simple thing. Asked me a couple questions and then send my refill. Didn't know how much that was going to cost, right? It's not transparent. You have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Waited, got the EOB that told me what to expect for my billing. And it was like $295. for 3 minutes maybe with that position.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, you know, for that price you get an hour with me, you know, directly with me, like me sitting there with you digging in on all of your
yeah.
issues in direct care as a specialist. So I think there's going to be a bigger and bigger place for this model because both for physicians, you know, feeling stifled by the system and wanting to get out of it, to do healthcare the way they wanted to in the first place. And for patients, you know, just being like, well, I'm paying all this money anyway, and I'm not getting the quality of care that I want. I could get a lot more value for this money in a direct care system. I could get to know my doctor, whether it's primary care or a specialist, if I have an issue that needs a specialist. And I'm going to have probably, you know, hopefully a more direct route to that physician. I don't have to jump through all these hoops and leave all these messages and never get a call back, you know, sort of a thing. I actually can call these smaller direct care clinics and usually I'll get to talk to my doctor, or they'll call me back later. Or if there's a staff member that talks to me, it's someone who's basically the doctor's, you know, right-hand man or woman, and they're like connected at the hip. And so there'll be good communication. And you just get more value for the money that you spend in the direct care system, I think. So
yeah, I think there's no question.
So I think there'll be a balance that'll be struck with it. And I think there'll be more and more direct care that people will be able to seek if they want it.
Yeah, I think as people now are paying more, and the deductibles are paying more out of pocket, we through HSAs, or just even the deductibles of, like you said, $14,000 or something like that.
That's crazy.
You're essentially paying catastrophic care at this point, right?
Yep.
And so and you're paying a tremendous premium for that. And I think people are going to be, once they understand that there's a direct primary care, for instance. I mean, I have insurance, but I see a direct primary care doc, partly because I think it's better care. Mm-hmm. But also because, frankly, I mean, my copay is, what, maybe $50? It's the same. I pay $50 a month for direct primary care. So there's no reason not to.
Right.
I mean, I don't get sick very often, never see the doctor. I'm bad that way, but like most doctors, right?
Yeah.
But I think it, as you mentioned, that physicians are in favor of this sort of model, if they could see that it would work, that there's less risk to going into it.
Mm-hmm.
That once patients are demanding it, once the demand is there,
yeah,
I think you'll see a flood of people who go into this sort of model. And there'll be people who left in the traditional model who are like in hospitals, employees and things like that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it'll restructure healthcare. I think that's, you know, where we're going.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for the discussion.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I hope this was useful information and enjoyable. It was enjoyable for me to
talk to you. It was a pleasure. And if people want to find out more about Elegenuity, the links, of course, will be on the website, theparadox.com, which linked to your website. If people want to send you a message, like if they're thinking about doing this, would you just want them to send you an email or something
Sure.
Like that?
Yeah, another thing that's nice, I think, about the direct care community, primary care or specialists. There's not as many specialists yet, but there's a few of us. The community, I think, is all open to trying to help each other forge our path. So absolutely. Our work email is hello@allergenuityhealth.com. I'm assuming the spelling of that will be kind of listed around the podcast,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Yeah. Cause I know that's probably not, doesn't just roll off the tongue. But yes, if anybody wants to send me an email, I'm always happy to either share more of our course or give you any advice or teach you the things that I wish I knew earlier as we plunked along on our way. So hopefully more people can, you know, consider their options and build their career the way they wanted to, you know, and feel like the doctor they wanted to be.
Are you on Twitter or Facebook or anything else that people can find you?
Yes, I'm on Facebook. Both our clinic is and me personally. I am on Twitter now. My husband, who's, you know, he's the more business marketing kind of side of our clinic. He's been bugging me about that for a long time. And I finally caved. So he made me an account. And I think my only tweet so far has been the, you know, hello, I'm on Twitter or tweet or whatever it says at the beginning. But it's,
that's not going to get many retweets, just so you know.
What's that?
I said it won't get you a lot of retweets,
no,
just so you know.
No. Although he has been getting me followers. He's been kind of going out on my account and trying to get me some followers so that once I have them, he was like, now you have followers, now you need to start tweeting. So yes, I'm available via Twitter, and I will probably start using it a little bit more in the future.
All right. Well, Thanks again so much for being on. I appreciate the time.
Awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what The Doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.
Right. So I probably should start the interview officially.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I was just looking at the clock. Holy cow. This is my problem. I really just enjoy talking to people about these.
No, that's great.
Because they usually have interesting stories. I'm like, oh, yeah, I probably should start.
Yeah. So.